Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to the New Books Network, and this is the Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery Podcast. My name's Lucas Rickert, and welcome to everyone. So I'm thrilled to talk with Dr. Benjamin Breen this episode. Who is Benjamin? He's an assistant professor in the history department at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He trained as an early modernist at the University of Texas at Austin, and then he held a postdoc at Columbia University. Let's see, he's written a lot. He's contributed to The Atlantic and to Slate and to Eon. He's written for the Pacific Standard and the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's also written a number of academic articles and chapters. But today, Ben and I are going to talk about his book. It's called The Age of Intoxication, Origins of the Global Drug Trade with the University of Pennsylvania Press. And it comes out this month. It actually comes out on the 20th. And so it's awesome. And it's awesome for a number of reasons, one of which it has a monkey on the cover smoking a pipe. And so you should absolutely get it for that reason, of course, but many others, which we'll get into today. So, Ben, it's fantastic to talk to you.
Hi, Lucas. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
So we'll get into the really deep questions in a couple of minutes, but I just want to kind of sketch out for listeners sort of the basic contours of the book. So The Age of Intoxication is a story, I suppose, of a time when drugs as we know them weren't really yet separated into convenient categories that we know now. So recreational drugs versus medicinal drugs, or legal versus illegal drugs. So there was no real serious distinction between the pharmacist and the drug dealer. And so I think it's very topical these days. So that's it. And sort of broad strokes, is that been sort of a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that... The book actually sort of focuses on the Portuguese Empire, so that's one thing to flag, that it's taking a different approach spatially to the story of drugs by moving out of, I think a lot of work on the drug trade, especially in the early modern period, is focused on Europe, especially European capitals like London, and this is trying to look more globally at how drugs emerged out of colonial spaces as well as in metropoles like London. But yeah, I think that's a good description of the book.
So Portugal, okay. I want to get into Portugal, but let's start off with you first, I guess. So tell us a little bit about your backstory and, how do you, decide on studying drugs in Portugal and elsewhere?
It's a really good question. It's a question that I've answered differently at different times, to be honest with you. So I had my answer for job interviews when I was in the job market that was slightly different than the answer I will give now. And so my job interview answer, which is true, but it's only part of the story, is that I was really fascinated. I've always been fascinated by the age of imperialism and its sort of legacies today, decolonization, and the ways we can see this sort of legacy of colonization all around us. And I guess for Portugal, the part of that is that my grandparents on one side were immigrants from Portugal. And so I kind of had a submerged sort of colonial legacy there as well, because they came by way of Brazil. And there's just a lot of that background that I always wondered about growing up. And then when I got into grad school, I was originally going to be an historian working on really an historian of magic and sort of early modern occult thought, which I'm still interested in. Okay. I was really fascinated by John Dee, this Elizabethan. Sometimes people say he's like the court astrologer to Queen Elizabeth, which is somewhat true. He was definitely like an advisor to Queen Elizabeth, as well as being an occultist and sort of a wizardly type of figure. Mm-hmm. And I got very deep in studying him, and then through him got really interested in his friend Sir Walter Raleigh, and then via that I got into the history of tobacco. I'm sure you're familiar with, there's a lot of great stuff on the history of tobacco. Mm-hmm. As well as amazing sources like King James Counterblast to Tobacco. So that was one way in, and just getting fascinated in the spice trade in general as an engine of imperialism, one of the real motive forces for why people like Raleigh or Columbus or Vasco da Gama were even doing what they were doing was searching for spices. And I came to realize that in the language of the 16th and 17th centuries, there basically was no distinction between spice and drug. They kind of lumped them together. And this is not just true in English, but it's true in Portuguese and Spanish and Latin. You know, they would call something aromata or aromatum in Latin, which you could literally translate that as spice or drug, depending on context. Okay. And the same is true, you know, in Portuguese, when they talk about, drugs of India, drogas da India, they could mean like cinnamon or nutmeg, or they could mean opium. And so that's really how I got into it as a topic, is just realizing that drugs meant something very different in the early modern period. And mm-hmm. I got fascinated by how they shifted and what that story was. And I couldn't really find a book that covered that entire history. So I just became interested in researching it for that reason. The part I didn't say in job interviews is that at the same time I started grad school in 2008, my sister, my older sister, became a cannabis grower in Northern California. Mm-hmm. In the medical marijuana industry. And so I got through her really interested in the contemporary impact of drug legalization and the sort of countercultures of drugs in the present day. And that kind of inspired my interest in pushing a colonial early modern story up into the present and finding connections with the present, of which I think there are many, but originally, that was sort of not. It took me a while to find a way to connect those two strands of interest, mm-hmm. And that's really what the book emerged out of.
Oh, that's fascinating! The way that you can be, you know, shaped what's happening in the present time, and then that, you know, helps you decide that you want to write about Portuguese drugs. And I didn't know that about you. That's cool. Part one of your book is called The Inventions of Drugs. Chapter one is called Searching for Drugs. Chapter two is Selling Drugs. And then chapter three is Fetishizing Drugs. You jump from 17th century Amazonia to West Central Africa. The breadth of the analysis is something that was a little bit eye-popping and knocked my socks off too. I mean, I study North America in the 20th century. And so it led me to think that you were complicating historians of drugs understandings a little bit more deeply. And understandings, I guess, of how boundaries are crossed, literal and figurative boundaries are crossed. Maybe I'm rambling. I'm sorry, but Can you tell me, what sort of other areas researchers need to go when we start thinking deeply about the history of drugs?
I think that, so you called your book Strange Trips in part to kind of get at that traveling nature of drugs, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's really insightful. I think that's true. That's also part of what interests me in drugs is that they're by nature, they cross boundaries, right? Mm. So they're consumable objects. So they move from being an external space to an internal space. They move from being materials to things which are influencing the mind or body in a somewhat, a materially based way, but a way that we don't experience that way. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they're boundary crossing, but they're also major commodities. And part of what my book is doing is kind of uncovering the ways that drugs became commodified. And in that process of commodification, they became major conduits for globalization. So I think one thing that I personally believe is really understudied in the early modern world, but also just in history more generally, is the ways that drugs and medicines had a larger impact, not just commercially or in the realm of, things associated with drug culture, like opium dens or tobacco smoking or taverns, but also just the ways they helped create many elements of modern life. So one thing I've been wanting to read a book on that I hope someone is working on is drug advertising in the early modern period. I think it's really a fascinating thing. As far as I can tell, some of the earliest printed advertisements in history were for drugs. So I'm thinking of ads in the back of books printed in the 17th century, mm-hmm. Which would have, things like, William Salmon's pills or Sydenham's drops, which were like laudanum derivatives. These mm-hmm. kind of things are, as far as I can tell, one of the foundation stones of modern advertising. And then if you look at a magazine from if you look at Life magazine from the 40s or 50s and count how many of those ads are for liquor or cigarettes, it's like the majority, right? So I think that's kind of an underrated element in not just advertising, but just the whole modern commercialized world that we live in.
Yeah.
It's hard to understate how important, especially addictive drugs, were for helping make that possible. And that's another thing, is just the idea of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few people I know working on that, but I really think it's a very compelling angle on especially the period of the slave trade, the period of the rise of global capitalism, to see it through the lens of addictive substances. And also, I'm thinking here not just about tobacco and alcohol, but, Sidney Mintz, his work on sugar. I think that's a really effective way of thinking about what drives global trade.
Mm-hmm.
It's often things that we have a habitual hunger for, something that maybe is not a necessity, but something that we kind of, as a society, fetishize or think of as something to be desired, right? Yeah. And so I really think that there's a larger scope for the history of drugs that goes beyond just studying individual substances or seeing them just in the context of the history of medicine, where a lot of the good work has been done, I think, so far.
So, by the way, the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy, where I'm at, we've got this trade catalog collection that goes back to the late 1700s that, showcases quite a few of these ads that you're talking about. But it's Europe and the United States. And so, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I'd like to see it in other places as well.
I mean, one of the ads I was thinking of is actually a pamphlet that was printed in Guatemala circa 1700, and it's an advertisement for a local drug, and it's just one of those things that I just found in the John Carter Brown Library in Providence, and I think it only exists in one copy now. It's like this kind of these sort of documents exist in archives, but they haven't really been contextualized or brought together. In part because they're so far flung, and also because it's just really hard to make a larger narrative out of them, I think. I think it's easier to make a narrative about, the rise of medical doctors in 18th century London, for instance, like Roy Porter type, his type of work, where there's a really rich source base and documentation. So that's the real challenge, is trying to go beyond a Eurocentric understanding by creative use of sources or looking further afield for texts. And that's actually what led me to Portugal, because Portugal has a really rich history of involvement in the drug trade and in medical history, that goes back, you know, to the Middle Ages. But yeah, I would love to see people, for instance, working more on the history of medicine and drugs in Africa and sub-Saharan. I think that's a really rich field.
Yeah, there was a conference in South Africa recently that I couldn't attend. It was Wellcome Trust funded. It's the dichotomy between good and evil when it comes to medicines, why we think of some as bad, why we think of some as good. And I'm hopeful that, you know, some intriguing studies come out of that conference. But, you know, for you, what you were just talking about leads me naturally, I think, into sort of another question, which happens to be about, so early modern is your period, right? And so for folks who are listening who don't might know what early modern is, the time period is, what would you say your time period is?
Well, I'm about to teach an early modern history survey to some students here at UC Santa Cruz. And when I teach that, I usually just tell them it's from Columbus to the French Revolution. I think those are two good touchstones that people all kind of know roughly when that was in both cases and why it's important. I think that you can push the boundaries a little bit. I like to think of it as about 1450 to 1820.
Okay.
And really, I think it's sort of nebulous. Like it's on both ends, you know, in the 15th century and the 19th century, you can kind of push those. But the big stories involved are the rise of European imperialism, demographic transitions toward urbanization. It's a big one, not just in Europe, but around the world. And of course, the slave trade in the Atlantic. And the biggest story of that period, in my opinion, is the massive depopulation of the Americas due to warfare and epidemic disease and just the effects of European colonization on indigenous peoples in the Americas.
Absolutely huge. And so I'm going to make a sweeping statement here, and it has to do with the way people regard history. But, you know, you talk to people out on the street and they might think that what you're talking about in that period might not impact them as much as what happened 15, 20 years ago or 50 years ago. It's kind of what you'd call a sort of presentist thinking. You know, can you just say what the value is? I mean, I hate asking that question, but I mean, can you unpack sort of the big picture significance of your book for people who think this way, who think that, you know, maybe thinking about the 1500s doesn't matter as much as the 1950s?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I do a lot with my students because they often have the same question. And I think in the case of this book, the answer has a lot to do with what the stakes are in the present and how those have antecedents and causes that go back centuries. I think we often forget how we ended up like this. And so what I'm talking about when I talk about the stakes, a big part of it is the massive prison population. I'm thinking specifically in the United States, but elsewhere as well, that has been caused by drug laws. The criminalization of certain drugs has been one of the most detrimental social forces of the last century, purely because, or in large part because, it led to such a massive rise in imprisonment of people who are committing nonviolent offenses. So just in terms of stakes, that's a huge thing. We're talking about millions of people's lives that have been permanently altered by these laws. And the connection to the past is that even if these laws maybe date to the 1960s or, you know, sometime in the 20th century, the rationale behind them, the reasoning behind them, is really a colonial rationale. It can be tracked back to legacies of imperialism, of racism, fears of the exotic, or the, you know, fears of non-European or non-Christian mm-hmm. forms of spiritual practice. And even the idea of prisons, in fact, is coming back from the early modern period. The whole system of criminalization really is an early modern thing. So that's one part of it. Another is just that I think of a lot of people today who are interested in issues of drugs or addiction and recovery, or just even just what I was talking about before, like the role of globalization and global trade in history. We see it as such a modern phenomenon that we forget how it started. I mean, that if we're trying to understand why there is a global drug trade, and not just in legal drugs, I mean, some of the largest companies in the world, as you know, are pharmaceutical companies, but there's also a huge black market. I mean, I was reading a statistic that if you factored the illegal drug trade into global GDP, it would actually like change the numbers pretty significantly. Mm. It's like a pretty good chunk of global gross domestic product. Something like 1% is spent on the illegal drug trade. And so understanding that is not just a matter of like sort of niche early modern, you know, stories, but it's really about understanding the world we live in. Mm-hmm. And then the other part is, of course, you know, I was writing this book during the heyday, if you will, or the high point of what they now call the opiate epidemic. Mm-hmm. When I started the book, it wasn't really even called that. You know, I started thinking about this book in 2009, 2010, right when there was just beginning to be, I think, a media attention focused on companies like Purdue and Johnson & Johnson and these major opiate manufacturers. But in many ways, I think that's a continuation of an 18th century story. As opiates move from being something that is, you know, a very old part of human society, like opium use, it goes back very, very far. Mm-hmm. But commercial trade in opiates, and particularly advertising of opiates, is really a product of the 18th century. And so if we want to understand why there's an opiate epidemic, if we want to understand why there's an illegal drug trade, why there's a huge prison population due to that trade, I don't think we can look at the 20th century for answers. I think we have to look to the 17th and 18th centuries to know how we got here in the present, and also what the future is going to be. Because the big, and to me, the most fascinating thing about drugs is that they're constantly changing. They're not fixed. They're always being reshaped, both legally, but also culturally, in their positioning, by every passing generation. So if we want to get a sense of where we're headed, I don't think it's going to look much like the 20th century. I think the best guidebook we can have for that is by seeing the deep history of drugs and how much they've changed to allow us to make predictions about the future.
So if people are listening to this, they should buy this book, which is called The Age of Intoxication, right away. All right, because it helps us understand what's going on. And I think you, that paints a picture that's just, I think, really important for us to take a look at as well. So the U.S., right? You've talked a lot about the U.S., the prison population, which is, excuse me, partially based on, you know, mandatory minimum sentences and prescriptions that are written by physicians that have to do with detail men and women talking to doctors about the value of different opiates and opioids. But I think the book has importance and resonance, obviously, beyond the shores of the United States. And I think that historians are starting to take and you're within that group, taking a look beyond the United States, decentering, if you will, or decolonizing drug history narratives. And so if you accept this premise that I'm putting to you, can you say a bit more about some of the changes that are taking place and how historians and other scholars are examining drug policy moving ahead?
Yeah. It's a big question. I think that there's a lot of good work being done right now on, as you say, sort of decentering or decolonizing drug history. I'm thinking of Abena Dove Osio Asari's book, Bitter Roots. Mm. Did you hear that one?
Yeah.
It's about the 19th century drug trade in Africa, and like the idea of the emergence of bioprospecting, I think, is a really interesting example of that. It used to be told as a sort of triumphalist history of old school history of medicine narrative of, you know, heroic doctors going to the jungle and recovering this substance that usually gets thought of as a pharmaceutical, a classic example being quinine, right? Mm-hmm. I think now there's a lot of work that's looking at the earlier context, or not even earlier. I mean, it's often a parallel history, but the non-European context for bioprospecting, like Matthew Crawford's book, The A Day in Wonder Drug, about the plant that quinine is extracted from, cinchona, is a really good example of that, where it's not taking it as a teleological narrative of this is how Western medicine discovered, quote unquote, this, you know, this drug in the jungle that then became a pharmaceutical. It's really looking at the roots of that story, taking it seriously epistemologically and historically, that there might be more to this than just how a pharmaceutical was extracted from a plant, seeing that plant as a more in a more holistic way, perhaps, or in a larger context, social context that isn't just one of European medicine. I think that's really promising. And I also think it kind of speaks to something that I've been interested in as I reach the end of this book, the globalization of alternative medicine, right? Like it's not a United States story that people are using a hybrid of Western medicine and alternative remedies. I think that's really emerging as sort of the global standard in many ways, like the rise of herbal medicine as a global consumer good, right? And I think in many ways that's kind of almost a return to an older global norm that we kind of had a blip in the 19th and 20th centuries of a really, really strong focus on prescription drugs that I think we're kind of witnessing a turn back from. I think you could even link in the decriminalization of cannabis, actually. Cannabis, not just in the United States, but in other countries as well, globally, as part of that. You know, like all this, I've been interested lately in medical research on CBD, for instance. And how that's sort of emerging as a pretty major force in global health and medical treatments, not just as like a recreational drug. Yeah. So that's something I've been keeping my eye on. And we can talk maybe later also about what some people are calling the psychedelic renaissance, which I see is very much part of that too.
So what's your take on spirituality, Ben? Because, I mean, one thing that struck me at the beginning of your book is you talk about how different drugs should be thought of through various lenses, and one of which was the spirituality side.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's I could talk about historically or on a personal level. On a personal level, I'm somewhat allergic to some claims of spiritual forces around drugs because I think they can easily be co-opted for commercial ends. So or used sort of by like snake oil salesmen in a manipulative way. I mean, this is a really reoccurring thing. There's a lot of great work on so-called quack doctors in the early modern period, which I often think of when I see the more sort of fringe claims made about certain substances today. Like I'm thinking of like ayahuasca, you know, people saying ayahuasca cures cancer and so forth. That's a whole can of worms that I think is, have a healthy amount of skepticism toward just from reading the history of these sort of attempts to inject spiritual significance into really what is really a commodification of a substance. Like if someone's a salesman for a substance, I'm pretty skeptical of those claims. But at the same time, I think that because drugs have become such a sort of object of global capitalism, we've stripped away a lot of that earlier, and in many ways, much richer surroundings for them, not just as items to be bought and sold, but as sacramental substances, or even just tools of sociability, like substances that have more value than just on the marketplace. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. And as an historical topic, it's really rich because you get a lot of insight into how people think, into the history of mentalities via drugs. That's really the root of my interest in drugs in many ways, is that you can see people's everyday life and you can get some insight into their inner life, by looking at the ways that they use drugs, superstitions around drug use. And one I always think of today is, you know, tobacco smokers who have a lucky cigarette that they turn upside down in the pack. You know, there's a lot of superstitions around smoking to this day.
I've never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's pretty common. Or like, I think a white lighter is considered bad luck by smokers, this sort of stuff. But a lot of it has a very old history. So there, I think of that as sort of a, you know, modern day echo of a lot of the social roles around drugs being grounded in religious belief. So tobacco, certainly in indigenous societies in the Americas, was very much grounded in spirituality. But the one I always go to when I teach that we sort of take for granted, perhaps, is in Catholicism, right? You know, I grew up Catholic, and like the idea that there's a holy wine that is literally the blood of God is, if you think about it, pretty out there. But it's also pretty in keeping with the ways that drugs in different cultures have been made sacramental. And it's actually in some ways become so familiar that we sort of forget how strange it is, you know?
When you mentioned the psychedelic renaissance, it reminds me of, I was going through patient reports, I guess maybe 3 weeks ago now. And basically these are reports written by people who are undergoing therapy. And the amount of times that God or spirituality or Jesus came up was pretty mind-blowing for me. So the idea that, you know, spirituality or higher power of some sort is embedded in that psychedelic experience, it isn't to be denied.
Yeah, I agree. It's actually sort of eerie to me how much these reports have resonance across not just decades, but even centuries.
Mm-hmm.
These same kind of themes keep popping up. And really not just in psychedelics too, but if you read, you know, I mentioned King James' Counterblast to Tobacco, he's framing it in language that sounds like a preacher. He's saying that the smoke of tobacco resembles the Stygian fumes of hell, you know, so he's very much making that link. And he's seeing tobacco smoking as linked to a cosmic battle between good and evil, which in his case meant Christianity and non-Christianity. It's very common to think of drugs in this sort of not just a moral way, but an intimately religious way. Mm-hmm. And I think that sneaks in to a lot of our discussions about drugs today without really people paying much attention to it. Mm-hmm. The ways that drugs became turned into immoral versus moral entities is often sort of freighted with a lot of religious categories and modes of thought that we don't necessarily interrogate or even pay attention to. And I think that's a great example that psychedelics, I mean, the classic example of a bad trip is like thinking that you died and went to hell, right? That's a very familiar theme when you read trip reports of people who had a bad time. It's just always sort of there in the background of people's thinking around drugs, I think.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So just to change directions very quickly, I had to tell you that your book, The Age of Intoxication, it's just beautifully illustrated. And everyone who's listening, they can also go to Benjamin Breen's website, which also is beautifully illustrated. But I just wanted to ask you, so Ben, what's your favorite image from your book, and you know, maybe why?
I actually got into history from wanting to be a painter. So I always have a very visual interest in the past. So I'm glad that that came across. I wish I could have made the images full color, because some of them are really beautiful. And I encourage anyone who buys the book to look up some of them on Google. You can find really good high resolution images for most of them. Cool. One that I'm a huge fan of, that I almost made the cover actually, is this print from 1620 by a printer named Matthias Greuter, which is in French, but in English translated, it's the caption is, the doctor cures fantasy and purges folly with drugs. And it's the one that looks like kind of like a brain scan. Someone I showed it to said it would look like a 17th century brain scan, because it's a really bizarre image. It's a person being pushed into a distillation apparatus that actually looks a lot like a pizza oven. and there's issuing out of the top of it, sort of as a distillate of his thoughts, mm-hmm. are the sort of visualized ideas in his head. So you can see what this printer thought were foolish thoughts in 1620. And it's like, you know, a really pretty horse, theatrical masks, a lute, a sword, hunting dogs, a monkey with a walking stick, a suit of armor, these sort of materialistic things, I think is what it's getting at. And it's literally showing drugs purging the foolishness out of this person's brain visually. And one of the things I wish I could have done a little detail of is that in the background, the drug jars are labeled with metaphorical terms. So in the background, it says one jar is labeled virtue, another is labeled wisdom, another is labeled intelligence. And so it's like this idea that really it's trying to see drugs as not just cures or medicines for physical ailments, but for mental ones too, right? Yeah. So that one I just think is such a rich image. And the other one I really love is an 1850s lithograph of an opium warehouse in India. And that one I just find really stunning because of the scale. So it's the thing I opened chapter 6 with, the chapter on opium. Mm-hmm. And it's, if you count the stories of these opium balls being stacked, it's literally, it seems to be as tall as like a 6-story building, straight up to the ceiling with giant balls of opium that if you think about it, is just mind-boggling. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. And I do kind of question whether the artist might have been exaggerating. Mm-hmm. I think they probably were pushing it on the scale, but I did research this opium factory, as it was called, in the British colonial parlance, basically a warehouse and stacking room. And the footprint of the building is huge. It still exists in ruins. So it seems to be based on reality. And if you look at just the amount of opium depicted in this image, it's enough to like pretty much kill hundreds of thousands of people via overdose. Like it's, if you think about it in that way, it's really, it's a powerful, powerful image.
One that has a resonance today too.
It made me think about Purdue Pharma, the sort of infamous company that made OxyContin, which I now think is, they went out of business, or at least they're in bankruptcy filings, mm-hmm. I think now.
Yeah. So at the top of the podcast, I did kind of joke, but I hope I didn't come across as offensive about the cover, which is a monkey smoking a pipe.
No, it's funny. It's a funny cover.
When I saw it, I was like, that is awesome. but what's the backstory with that, if there is one?
No, there's definitely a backstory. I have a blog called Res Obscura, where I have I think the most popular post on my blog of all time was called Why Are There So Many Paintings of 17th Century Monkeys Smoking Pipes? There's actually a lot of paintings like that. It's a whole genre of painting called Saint-Géry paintings, which are basically parodying, the way I read them is that they're parodies of early modern consumerism. Because in many ways, the early modern period, at least in Europe, but also more generally in Eurasia, in India, China, the Middle East, it was really the beginning of consumer culture, of which tobacco was one of the main motive sources of that, the idea that you had a tobacco pipe, you have a spice box, you have, you know, a set of cups to drink alcohol out of, perhaps, and that is your possession. It's like something that you are proud of. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at like dining sets from the 16th and 17th centuries, often the most expensive and ornate item is the salt cellar or the spice box. And then in 18th century, it's the snuff box, right? The drug delivery device. And so this became like a really great source of pride in the 17th century, but also an object of fun. And so I think the painters are making fun of this new materialism, this new consumer culture around drugs by showing these monkeys copying humans because they're the apes of humans, right? That's the way they thought about them. And looking really foolish as they do it. And I also think it's just a painting. It's a way of visualizing intoxication. So the monkeys are really not just consumers, but they're also drunk or stoned. You can kind of see it in their eyes. Yeah. And that's why I picked that one in particular, because the monkey has this kind of crazed look. He looks very stimulated, let's say. And I almost see the owl in the background as like a disapproving other animal. Mm-hmm. It has a sort of stern look.
Yeah, there's some judgment there.
There's some judgment there. So it felt like a good visualization of that sort of story. And my regret is that the back of the other part of the painting shows these monkeys cheating a cat at cards, which I really love. Because you kind of can make up a backstory that the monkeys got the cat drunk and now they're like, you know, playing a fast one on him. But yeah, if anyone's interested, just look up the artist is a 17th century Dutch artist called David Teniers, T-E-N-I-E-R-S. Mm-hmm. And he painted, as far as I can tell, dozens of paintings like this. And they're really cool images. I really like them.
It jumps off the page for me and I just have a good laugh. I couldn't figure out if I was weird for laughing at it or not.
So I think it's definitely funny.
Look, your book is like deeply, deeply researched and you got all sorts of sources in there. So you already mentioned Portugal, right? So did you have a good fun time researching this book in Portugal and elsewhere?
I mean, it was amazing. I can't thank enough all the archivists and other people I met in Portugal. It's a really good place to research a book. And it was a lot of fun. One of the things I really loved about it was that if anyone's ever been to Lisbon, who's listening to this, Lisbon has really amazing pharmacies. They're really old and well-preserved. And so sometimes I would be studying some of the more esoteric things that ended up being in the book. Like, for instance, this early modern drug called Mumia, which literally was powdered or ground up mummy. So this is like what's called a cannibal medicine. It's pretty out there, but surprisingly common. I mean, weirdly enough, 17th century Europeans were, as far as I can tell, the most enthusiastic cannibals in the entire world at that time, because it was very common to eat human body parts in the form of mumia. Not to mention to use it as pigment in paint. So the cover of the book has a lot of brown tones. It's not impossible that there's some mummy brown, as it was known, that was used in the paint of the cover. So mumia is really common as a, you know, commodified drug in the 17th century. Obviously it goes away because by the 19th century, people are horrified that priceless Egyptian mummies are being consumed as a cure for, colds or fevers or this sort of thing. But sometimes walking around in Lisbon, on at least one occasion, I walked into a pharmacy and saw a drug jar labeled mumia. And I wondered whether there's still some mummy in there potentially. And so you would see these 18th century drug jars in these pharmacies that still were just in the same spot. You know, they had just been in a pharmacy their entire lives. And, you know, now we're on display, obviously, as little curiosities, but it was really cool to see. Another fun thing that I found that I couldn't really find a way to work into the book, but it's always been on my mind ever since, was I did some research at the Royal Society Archives in London for a chapter looking at the connections between Portuguese drug merchants and the Royal Society of London, which is sort of like the first or perhaps the most famous scientific organization of the period. It's the one that, you know, Isaac Newton was a president of, and in many ways played a leading role in in the history of science in the 17th and 18th centuries. And I found a letter sent to Robert Boyle, the famous chemist and alchemist, from a German alchemist and drug researcher. And it was a little sample of some kind of drug that he had sent to him attached to the letter. It was like a little folded up envelope with some brown powder in it from the 1680s or something. And I showed it to the archivist and he was like, oh yeah, that might not be safe. There might be like some mercury in there or something. And I just opened it and looked at it and then put it away. But it's always been on my mind. It's just like this, it surprised me that there was still something like that just kind of sitting there in an archive. And other things, yeah, I really enjoyed exploring Lisbon, looking for archives. I went to Brazil and looked through the archives there. Unfortunately, a lot of the paperwork I was looking at is very damageable because it's, paper doesn't do well in the tropics.
Yeah.
So a lot of what I was doing was looking at papers where one whole side of it had fallen in some water, for instance, and had just gotten waterlogged and completely erased. But I could read like half of the document, and that was kind of fun just to decode those sort of things.
So stepping backwards then, I mean, earlier you and I were talking about, writing some histories from other parts of the world. So is the climate going to prevent and some of this damage going to prevent people from being able to write histories like this?
I mean, there definitely is a really urgent need for historical preservation of documents in places.
Gotcha.
That have issues with that. I definitely wish more funding was put on that because I can kind of see them being degraded, but I don't think so. I'm actually very optimistic about the future because these things are all becoming digitized. You know, since I started this project, most of the sources I looked at have become digitized, I would say. And that's really promising in terms of unlocking this research potential for people who don't have the resources to travel. Across oceans, people in the developing world who are maybe just only have internet availability, but not resources to go to archives, I think is a huge and kind of, under-recognized source of optimism for historical research. And I hope that more people work on digitizing these sort of manuscripts who are involved in archiving and libraries, because some of them are really amazing. I mean, just especially as visual sources, I think it would change the game for teaching, for instance, to have more of these apothecaries' notebooks digitized, because they're just really rich and beautiful. I was stunned by one in particular that had little doodles. It was an apothecary copying out recipes, but then above each recipe, he would draw like a little image of it. And then he drew a little self-portrait of himself. And it was just amazing. It's called the Farmaca of Joseph Coelho. It's owned by the National Library of Portugal. If anyone wants to look it up, it's really cool. But yeah, there's just so many. It's a very rich material base because it's not just diaries, letters, notebooks, but also it's actual physical objects, right? Drug jars, chest of drugs. Some of which, as a sideline, I think it would be really fascinating for archaeologists to begin doing DNA studies of some of these drug jars. A lot of them are made up of different animal parts from all around the world. If we could sequence them and see exactly where they came from, it would actually, I think, be really rich for the field in terms of opening up new questions.
That's intense.
Yeah, it is kind of, because if you're sequencing a mumia jar, then it gets into a whole sort of eerie world of, is it actually an Egyptian mummy? Is it fake Egyptian mummy, which a lot of people claimed at the time, meaning, someone just kills someone or digs up a body and then claims that it came from a mummy. There's a whole lot of strange angles you can go with that.
I wanted real mummy. Now I got fake mummy instead.
It's a pretty common complaint, actually. In fact, in Samuel Johnson's dictionary, he actually has an entry on mumia where he mentions that.
I wanted to get my money's worth. And now I got some fake mummy. Hey, so Ben, can you tell us, you must have a favorite story from the book or a couple of favorite stories. So like, what is it that jumps out? What pops for you with the book?
Yeah, there's a few. One person that I've always sort of thought about ever since, partly because I didn't get to find out her full story, was a female apothecary outside of the Portuguese city of Coimbra named Maria Coelho. Mm. And she has always been on my mind because, number one, that beautiful apothecary notebook that I mentioned, the illustrated one, is by someone named Joseph Coelho. And so I think they might have been related because it was made right around the same time in more or less the same place. And he has a drawing of a female apothecary in the notebook. So it would not surprise me if that was a drawing of her. But I actually know of her from an Inquisition file. Where she was effectively tortured and imprisoned for being what we now call a crypto Jew, meaning she was a converso. She was forcibly converted from Judaism to Christianity, but at least according to this Inquisition file, continued to uphold Jewish law. And so she was imprisoned for the charge of Judaismo, just for being secretly Jewish, and was actually expelled from the country and sent to port to Brazil, where she just disappears from the record. But I've always wondered what happened to her because I only have the first half of her story. And that's always, it's just one of those things that when you do research, you can never answer every question. And that's one that I've always wanted to know, what happened to her in Brazil, because she's penniless, she's cut off from her family, but she's trained as an apothecary. So I imagine she continued to be a healer of some kind, just in much reduced circumstances, I suppose. And the same holds true for a lot of the elements of the story that involve the slave trade. There's these really tantalizing stories of enslaved healers. People like, there's a great book by actually your colleague, James Sweet at University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It's a book called about a African healer named Domingos Alvarez, who is a really fascinating character because he moves between Africa, Brazil, and Portugal. And these people are just fascinating. I wish we could know more about them. But just in terms of like an interesting or funny story, the one I love from the book is this East India Company merchant named Thomas Bowery, who ends up in a port city in India called Machilipatnam and asks his bodyguard if he can find cannabis for him because he notices, as he puts it, everyone there uses Banga is what he's calling it. It's cannabis, edible cannabis or drinkable cannabis, instead of alcohol. So he's really intrigued by this. And he takes some with five or six other merchants and they get incredibly stoned. It's like, it's really, really remarkable how stoned they get. He says three or four of them lay upon a rug, complimenting one another in high terms, fancying ourselves to be as emperors, which I think is funny. And then another one sticks his head into a jar for 4 hours, weeping bitterly. So he's having a bad time. And then another one apparently beats his knuckles bloody boxing with a fence post. So I don't think I've seen anyone get that stoned in my entire life. So no. It's always stuck in my mind as a pretty remarkable reaction to cannabis intoxication. And then just as sort of a sad figure, this guy, George Salmanazar, we don't know his real name or even where he was from. He was probably from France, but he was an orphan who disguised his identity and ended up in turn of the century London, right around 1700, pretended to be a Taiwanese prince, which worked for a little while. He got to meet Isaac Newton in that disguise, as it were. He even apparently tried to teach his made up Taiwanese language to people. He just invented it whole cloth. Nice. But he's sort of a con artist, but in a way that I find somewhat sympathetic because he's an orphan and really just is trying to survive. But he ends up becoming an opium addict and leaves behind this really remarkable account of opium addiction, which predates Thomas De Quincey and pretty much any other addiction memoir I've heard of. He writes it in the 1720s and 30s and 40s. And after his death, in his will, he says, please publish this book. It's called The Confessions of XXXX, a reputed native of Formosa. Formosa is what Taiwan was called at that time, by the British. And, you know, it's mostly known as like a kind of funny or colorful story of an imposter. But I also see it as an addiction narrative, addiction and recovery, because he claims to have solved his opium addiction. But the way he solves it, it really points to how much our thinking about recovery has changed, because he says, rather than taking opium, I made myself a special combination of laudanum and cider, which I drink a pint of every night. And that has cured me. Of course, he's still an opiate addict by our standard, but he thinks that it's better, at least. And it becomes this whole like redemptive narrative of his life.
Those are awesome stories. Those are really awesome. So, hey, what's next now? You've crossed this off the list, and the book's coming out on the 20th of December, which is pretty soon. Are you turning the page, so to speak, and moving on with another project?
Yeah, I'm. I thought I would make my next book on the history of magic and technology, which has always been my other big interest. And I have a whole project on that, but I unexpectedly got really caught up in the 20th century history of psychedelic drugs while I was finishing up this book, because I started reading a lot of ethnobotany and anthropological work from sort of mid 20th century people. Things like, have you read Mike Jay's book on mescaline? It's called History of the First Global Psychedelic.
Yeah, it's a great book.
That type of material really started to grab me. It was really just because I was sort of fact-checking my book and looking through the existing literature on things like peyote, mescaline, psilocybin mushrooms, their context of indigenous use in Mexico and Mesoamerica. But through that, I got really just sort of taken up in this story that I didn't know existed of the uses of experimental drugs in the 40s and 50s. I always thought that Timothy Leary was sort of the beginning of that when it comes to LSD. Or, you know, if you go back a little earlier, people like Humphrey Osmond, who's in your book, right? Do you talk about him?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, he's fascinating. Captain Hubbard, Aldous Huxley. But I kind of vaguely knew of that stuff. But then there's all these other stories that popped up that I had never heard of. Margaret Mead was involved in LSD research, doing ethnographies of people on LSD in the early to mid 50s, for instance, or finding out about all these people I had never heard of, but who really were influential, like Oscar Janiger. He was Cary Grant's psychiatrist. He gave Cary Grant LSD, and apparently Cary Grant took LSD at least 80 times in his life, which is kind of remarkable. And these kind of things really got me interested in this other book project that is not just about psychedelic drugs, but it's really about the new culture of experimentalism in the post-war period, immediately post-war. So it's sort of how the atomic bomb research inspired this new sense that technology could be transformative, both in good and bad ways, that it could actually change the trajectory of humans, not just help them along their way. And that gets tied up, I think, in the rise of psychopharmacology, what comes to be called psychedelic drugs, but also in hormone therapy. So I'm actually writing a book now that is contextualizing psychedelic drug history of the 40s and 50s against the history of what's called narcosynthesis. So using sedatives in treatment as a sort of therapeutic tool for catalyzing emotion. And also in the context of hormone therapy for gender confirmation. The very early stories of trans men and women are strangely tied up with the history of psychedelic drugs. They're often taking both in the 40s and 50s, I found. And the people who are involved in treating people with schizophrenia are also involved in psychedelic psychiatry and in gender confirmation surgery and hormone therapy. So it's a story that I'm still kind of researching, but I'm really excited about it because it's just the main takeaway for me is that the 60s was a conservative retrenchment period from this earlier period of experimentalism, that it was actually society and even scientists themselves reacting against an older period of utopian thinking and optimism about what drugs can do. In some ways, you can see the 60s and 70s, I think, is the hangover from that immediate post-war period, as opposed to seeing it as like this counterculture break with, you know, the men in the gray flannel suits of the 50s, which is how I used to see it.
Oh, that's off the charts. Interesting, man, especially with all the different topics at play butting up against each other.
Yeah, that's the challenge. I'm still figuring out how to kind of package it. You know, that's the problem with the book is you need to have the one sentence description of it. That took me like a paragraph, so I'm not there yet. But I've been pretty deep in researching it this year.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. And I just got to say again, thanks so much for taking the time to talk. This has been the New Books Network Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast. And today we've been talking to Benjamin Breen about The Age of Intoxication, Origins of the Global Drug Trade, which is coming out December 20th with the University of Pennsylvania Press. So thanks so much again.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.